Cool, thanks. If I would have known you were going to say I was cool, I would have been here 10 minutes ago. So thanks, Bridget. Really appreciate it. Thanks, Mark, for the invite. My name is Gary, and I'm a person in long-term sobriety. Hi to some of my friends out there. I see Dave, and I see who else is out there? I see Bob's out there and a few other folks I know from Writers for Recovery. Anyway, I've never been in an done an AA meeting. I've never been a speaker at an AA meeting. I think I have gone to two. This one other time, I think when Nellie spoke, and another time when friends of mine spoke. So it just seems a little bit weird, but I checked it out with Mark, and he said, don't worry about it. You can talk about politics and sex and religion and sobriety and food and whatever you want, and take as long as you want. So I would like to welcome all of you to my 4-hour lecture. It's called Having Sex with Food While Drinking. And I hope you enjoy it. I tried to think of what I wanted to tell you about myself. And I think a really important thing is that I grew up in a kind of what I think of as a special place. It was a little town in the northeast of the United States in a state called Pennsylvania, a place called Eldred, Pennsylvania. And it was a tiny town of about 800 people. And it was really an idyllic place in a lot of ways. It was very rural and beautiful, and all the, moms and dads had good jobs at the factories, and all the kids would run around and play together all day and everything. But, so in a lot of ways, it was like something you'd see out of a movie or something, kind of paradise for kids. But it was also a place where drinking was a huge part of life, where it got modeled for us that way, that that's just what you did. You went to a picnic or a party or whatever, and there was a keg of beer, and all the grown-ups just, got drunk and had a good old time. The first time I remember drinking at a bar was when I was 5 years old. Now, I was drinking orange soda, mind you, but I was sitting next to my dad, and my dad would take me to the bar. My mom worked on weekends, and she would leave early in the morning. And then, about 11 o'clock, my dad would start getting antsy, and he'd say, "Let's take a ride in the car." And we would go to this place called the Betty Blue, it was called. And it was called that. There was a refinery across the road called the Eldred Refinery, and they made Betty Blue gasoline. And so the bar was, it was a bar where the workers would go when they were off shift, to have a drink. And I would go there with my dad, and I'd sit at the bar and drink my orange soda. And I learned I could go under the bar and like harvest the bubble gum, and like use it again. I finally got, I think I got caught at that. And I was told that wasn't cool. And then there was a little room, there was like a special dining room called the Blue Room, where I would just go in, and it would be empty, and everything was blue, all the tablecloths and everything. And while my dad drank, I would just go in and, crawl under the table and just sit there, and I don't know, imagine stuff and have little imaginary adventures. And then when my dad got tired of drinking, sometimes we'd go across the street to the American Legion, and drink over there with all the veterans. And that was a pretty sad place, really. There were all these old World War II guys who just sat at the bar and stared at the TV and drank and drank and drank. At a certain point, despite growing up in this kind of really placid environment, except for that part of it, which I didn't really know, I thought I was fine, but I discovered that I was a cowbird. And I wanted to tell you guys about cowbirds, because I found myself to be one, and I went on the internet and I got a little bit of information because, it's on the internet. I wanted to, share it with you because if it's on the internet, it's true. And this is what it says about cowbirds. I don't know what, if any of you guys are bird people, but they're just a small little brown bird, but they have a unique thing. Cowbirds are brood parasites, meaning that rather than raise their young themselves, They ditch their eggs and other species' nests and allow these forced foster parents to do the tough work of chick rearing. Baby cowbirds grow up with families that neither look nor act anything like them, sometimes in habitats in which cowbirds don't even really live. And I feel like that really was my story, that I was born and I grew up in a family that was nothing like me, you know. My parents were very conservative. My parents were very straight, you know, straight line people. And everybody kind of thought the same way. My sisters were that way too. We were, you know, a conservative, rural. We didn't really care much about the life of the imagination. We didn't read books. We didn't have art. We didn't really, you know, participate in any of that stuff. And that was all the stuff that was really important to me. You know, I love to just sit around and read books. You know, I love to look at art and I love to listen to music. And that was just a really a big part of my life. And I guess when I was really young, it was okay. You know, when you're little, when kids are little, they kind of fit in together. They don't really care about a lot of differences. And then, so when I found out I was a cowbird was when I hit puberty and everybody else did too. And that's like the great time when the sorting begins, right? You begin to discover that there's differences between you, and those differences are really pretty meaningful. And in the community that I grew up in, you know, books and things like that weren't important. What was important was football. For those of you Irish people, it involves an oblong ball, and you put on helmets and you run around. It's not like rugby where you have to be really crazy to run around with the oblong ball because you don't have a helmet. Anyway, and that was what was important in my community, was, you know, being a tough guy, being a football player, and killing a deer. You know, you had to be a deer hunter. Where I grew up, everyone hunted. And those were kind of the two things that really set you apart as a guy or as a young man. And I wasn't any of those things. I was like scrawny and nerdy and shy and bookish. And I didn't, you know, so I was out of that whole thing. I was a Boy Scout, which I loved, and I learned a lot of really cool things. But, you know, at the time, if you ever wanted to screw over your social life, just like be a Boy Scout and you would be out the band. And you know, I wanted to be a part of what the other kids were up to, but I just wasn't. I just didn't, you know, fit. I was in love with this girl named Brenda Tyler. Oh my God. She had big blue eyes and she had chiclet teeth, like chiclets, you know, her front teeth, not the little tiny chiclets that would make her look really weird, but the big, nice chiclets and curly brown hair. I was so in love with her. And I just, I didn't dare to tell her, you know, I thought she would just laugh at me. And you know, by the time I reached like middle school, I just wasn't part of shit. I got bullied a lot. I just started blowing off school. You know, I would just say, fuck it, I'm not going to go, you know, I'll just fake sick, stay home, whatever, rather than deal with, you know, going to school and having people give me shit. I'll just, you know, I'll just stick around. And I didn't feel like I could confide any of this shit to my parents. Like, my mom was really, really nice, sweet person. And I loved her very much. She was a nurse. And in this little town, she was the nurse for the whole community, kind of. Our phone would ring all hours, you know, day or night. Somebody's sick, somebody's hurt. And my mom would be on the phone, you know, giving advice or telling people how to take care of their sick kid or whatever. And she was just a great lady. But my dad was kind of the opposite of me. He went to the eighth grade and he wasn't interested in, you know, books or anything. He worked in a factory and he drank, you know, he drank a lot. Every day he went to work. And as soon as he got off, he went straight to the bar and he would drink, you know, all afternoon and come home at dinner time. And he could just be a totally brutal bastard. And he would slap us around and, you know, all that kind of thing. I remember once he was beating my sister with a belt so bad, you know, and we had guns in the house, you know, because we all hunted. And I said, if you don't fucking stop beating her up right now, I'm going for the gun, you know, and I'm glad he stopped because I think I probably would have done it. And so my parents couldn't be like a lot of help and support to me in that time. And I just wanted to read you one more little thing about cowbirds. This is what it says. Cowbirds and their parents. Cowbirds have to figure out who they are without their biological parents. The shocking thing is that somehow most of them do. Like human teenagers, young cowbirds sneak out at night. Though unlike human teenagers, these chicks' evening rendezvous seem to be with members of their own family. And so, I mean, what I really think I had to do was just find my family, because I didn't feel like I belonged to my own. And I needed to find one. And when I was about, you know, 15 or 16, the way I found that family was that I discovered drinking. There was a little game room in town, you know, and I would go there sometimes and play foosball or pinball. And we lived in Pennsylvania. The drinking age was 21 in Pennsylvania, but we were 3 miles from the New York border. And the drinking age there was 18. So you can guess where anybody who had a car went, you know, every Friday night, and all the liquor stores and the bars on the border, they did a boom in business with all the kids. We all had, you know, shitty fake IDs, and they all knew they were fake. They didn't care, you know, they just wanted our money, and we'd head over there. And so the first time I ever went, I was hanging out at the game room with some guys, and, you know, we're like, we're going to get beer. And I just jumped in and said, I want to go, you know. And we went, and I can remember I bought a little 8-pack, little 7-ounce, 8 bottles. It was called Tiger's Head Ale. And I just bought it. Everyone else drank, you know, Budweiser, but I had, you know, I was different. I liked that Tiger's Head Ale because it was exotic. It had a tiger on it, you know. And we got back and we went out in the alley behind the thing, and I opened up that beer and I swallowed it down. And I was 16. Now I'm 60 almost. I can still remember the feeling of my whole body just melting, you know, like everything that sucked, everything that, you know, all my anxiety, all my feeling like an outsider, everything, just the minute that alcohol came into my body, all of that shit just started to melt, you know, and that was it for me. I was just like on board with it, you know. And pretty soon, you know, my awkwardness, I could drink and I could have a conversation with somebody. I could drink, I could talk to a girl, I could drink, I could tell somebody to fuck off if they were being mean to me, you know. All that shit was possible for me. I also discovered a family, because the minute I started to drink, I was in with everybody else who did too. My buddies and I, we had a group called the Quartz Crew, Quartz, like quarts of beer, because we did the math and we discovered that was the cheapest way to buy beer, is if you bought a case of 12 quarts of it, you know. So we would pool up all our money and we'd drive to New York State and we buy, you know, a case of quarts of beer, and then we just get puke and smashed, you know. And that, you know, could the first test was, could you guzzle a whole quart, you know, without stopping, tip up a whole quart and just drink it, you know, and without puking all over the ground, and whether you did or you didn't, it didn't really matter, because and we were out, you know, we were out doing small, you know, crime, vandalism, and, you know, raising hell all over the place, driving drunk all over. And that was my, you know, that was my life then. I felt like I had, you know, friends. I did. Of course, one of the reasons I had friends is because I also had a job and they didn't. So I had the money to buy the beer. So I was kind of popular for that reason. But you know, it was like my first real identity where I felt like, wow, I'm cool. I'm in, you know, I'm proud of something. You know, I can fucking party, you know, and I got that reputation of someone who could do that. And it was really like, as much as the beer, it was intoxicating to me, you know, that like I had a reputation now, you know, I had a reputation as the guy who could, you know, stay up all night and drink. And it was really important to me. It became my identity. And, you know, and then I was a smart kid. I got good grades all the time. And I didn't really have any idea why. I just knew you were supposed to go to college. So I enrolled in college and I went off, and there I became a cowbird again, because I was a hick from the country. All the kids in school were like, you know, they were worldly people. They knew about, you know, going to Europe and traveling and eating fancy food and all that. But then again, I found those, you know, those same people, they liked to party as much as I did. And college for me was skipping class, drinking, getting fucked up all the time, skipping class. I started smoking weed. My roommates turned me on to smoking weed, which I'd never done when I was young. And, you know, I gained a reputation there too, you know, for someone who could really, really party. And also I was studying something I wasn't good at. I was just wanted to be a biologist because I loved, you know, animals, I guess, like cowbirds or birds and other animals. And I hunted and I fished, but I couldn't do the science part. I just hated it. And so I was pretty, you know, college for me was just a big long party. I met this girl that I liked, you know, and I met her at a bar one night, and I, you know, I thought, oh, this is my big, big chance. But the problem was that I got too drunk before I showed up, and I, you know, the first drink I took sitting across the table from her put me over the top, and I threw up all over the table. And that was kind of the end of that girl. She was out and I was out. And then I did find a girlfriend, and she was worse than me. She was drunk. She was high. We had, you know, our relationship was just fights and awfulness. When I was a senior, I ran out of money. I didn't have any money to pay my tuition. I had to go get a job, and I couldn't find a job. And I went to the library and I started to just read, just sit in the library and read, which I hadn't done for some time since I was a kid. And then I started to write. And it was like I discovered something magic. I started making up stories. I started telling stories just on the paper and a little typewriter in my room at my apartment. And in that time I was off, I decided, fuck science. I'm gonna be a writer now. And I changed my major, and it was like a whole new world opened up for me. I loved it. I went back to school and I studied literature and I studied writing, and I got straight A's. I got terrible grades in college before that. And I found that I was good at something. My teacher said, you know, you've got some talent. And that was kind of the beginning of sobriety for me. I shouldn't say sobriety, but the beginning of a change in my life, because I certainly wasn't sober. I was still, you know, drunk and high all the time, but I was just getting my homework done. After that, I got out of college and I moved to Boston, to a city that I really loved. And I found weirdos like me. And it was awesome. I fell in with people who were different, you know, who were different, who I'd never met people like that before. They played music and they wrote poetry and they painted and they sculpted and they, you know, and I thought, you know, musicians were, you know, really rich guys who you'd never get to know, and artists were famous people, and writers were guys that, you know, drove a Mercedes and drank single malt scotch and lived in, you know, New York City. And I never realized that there were actually ordinary people who were writers, you know, who were artists, who were musicians. And I started hanging out with these people and it was like, oh my God, you know, these must have been the friggin' kind of people who put their egg, my egg in my parents' nest and like left me there. Like, those are the birds I came from, you know? And I started realizing that, there was this whole other world for me. But if you read my diaries, and I this is the only time I kept a diary was then during that time I lived in Boston, and in all of the huge numbers of the entry were like this: all you do is take drugs. You're a fucking loser. You're a drunk. You're never going to be a writer. You know, what the fuck is wrong with you? Get your shit together. You know, you're just a fucking idiot. And like, I guess I still hadn't been able, you know, to love myself. You know, I hadn't been able to like think that I had, you know, value as a person. And I still hung out. One of my best friends was a drug dealer. Of course, he was my best friend because I also had money and he sold drugs and I was willing to buy them. So, you know, those were the people I hung out with, the people who drank, the people who did drugs. And I, at one point I was living in an apartment and I needed a roommate. And this really kind of oddball guy came in off the street one night, or called me and said, hey, I'm interested in the room. And he came over and he looked around. He said, okay, I'll take it. I said, wait a minute. I don't even know who you are. He goes, well, you're advertising a room, right? Like, well, I want it. I mean, I'm a good guy, whatever. And so I said, okay, you know, come and live here. And he turned out to be a lifelong friend. He was, not only was he sober, he'd never really had a drink in his life. Not only did he not do drugs, he'd never really tried a drug in his life. And I had worked all these dead end jobs. You know, it's not like you're going to get, you know, a good, decent job when you're half wasted all the time. But the first job I got in Boston was as a substitute teacher. And the first day I walked in, the first class I taught, there were three kids in the class that I'd bought a bag of weed off of and gotten high with like a week before. So that's the kind of situation I was in. But this guy came in, he said, I work for this publishing company downtown and, you know, you want to be a writer, I'll get you a job. We need a photo researcher. And I said, what's a photo researcher? He said, you know, it's a guy that finds all the photos that they put in a, you know, they were for textbooks for kids, you know, social studies and whatever. We need someone to find all those photos we put in there. And, you know, we need you to do that. I said, well, I've never done. They said, don't worry, I'll get you the job. So I went in and that was my in. I started working in publishing. I became an editorial assistant. And, you know, I kept saying, but I want to be an editor. I want to be an editor. Oddly enough, the first real writing job I got was a magazine called The Local. And at the time there were tons of Irish people coming into Boston, like just a wave of young Irish people just invaded the city. This was in the 90s. They were everywhere. They were opening pubs and Irish music was everywhere. And this woman at the company I worked for started a magazine called The Local, and it was all about Irish music. And she's like, you want to write for the magazine? I said, sure. And so I got, started writing stuff about these Irish bands. I still remember one was called The Stunning. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of that band, but they were an amazing rock outfit, like a pop rock band from Ireland. And they would come over. I hung out with some of the guys from Silly Wizard. I think they're maybe Scots, but they were a big Celtic band at the time. And then I got the attention with that of people in the publishing company, and they decided to make me, an editor. At the time, still, I was hanging out with a really heavy party crew, even at this job. You know, that we'd go out every Thursday night, our paychecks, and just drink them, you know. Come home in a cab, blacked out, 3 o'clock in the morning, settle the bar bill the next morning. Everybody be sending around emails like, you stiffed me. Where's your money? But I became an editor and I was terrible at it. I was awful. I thought I was this big shit writer. And, cause I've been writing for, you know, this magazine, and there were these wonderful older women who were all the editors there, and they took me under their wing, and they probably should have fired me because I really didn't know what I was doing. But these people saw something in me, and they, you know, they taught me. They were like, this is why, you know, this is why your writing is not working. This is what's wrong with it. This is how you fix it. And they were just incredibly patient with me. And I started doing it right, you know, and I started feeling good about it. I started making a real paycheck and I started feeling like, you know, hey, I've got some talent now, some real talent in the world people will pay money for. I went off to graduate school and I studied fiction writing and I was really good at that. And I just loved it. And those were really my people. We would do a 10-day residency where we'd go to the school and live there for 10 days. And then we'd go back and do all our homework and mail it in to our advisors for the whole semester. And they'd mail us comments and whatever. And I never wanted to go home at the end of those 10 days. I mean, by then I was married. But I didn't want to go home back to my wife. I didn't have any interest in that. I wanted to be with these writers because they were my people. They were brilliant. They were funny. They were, you know, creative. They were crazy. And we all felt the same way about each other. We just loved each other. We were a real family. And I still, you know, I still have lifelong friendships from those times. The whole time I was at grad school, I was a heavy, heavy blackout drinker. And I never was a daily drinker. You know, I never was the guy who had to, you know, would get up in the morning, say, I got to have a drink. You know, I never drank on a work day during the day, but I was that guy who, I couldn't have one beer or one shot. I had to have all of them, you know, so it was like, open the bottle and either all the alcohol is gone or you're unconscious. That was the only two options for me anytime I drank. And since I had money, it was usually the unconscious part. So just innumerable, you know, blackout nights were kind of the story of my life even then. And I don't know why I got married when I did, but I did. I met this woman and I thought I loved her. I don't know if I did in retrospect, but we were married for about 4 years. And she said, you know, we got to have a baby or I'm out of here. So I thought about it and I said, all right, let's have a child. And, we went, when my wife was a few months pregnant, we went down to visit I was out of grad school by this time. And we went down to visit a friend of mine in Tucson, Arizona. Really probably one of my best friends from grad school and his wife, and she was pregnant too. And I just started, we were down there for 4 or 5 days and I just started thinking of all that, everything, you know, I was going to be a dad. I was a drinker. My drinking was a problem. And I really started thinking about my own dad, and how he behaved when I was a kid. And how he really terrorized our family in a lot of ways. He terrorized my mom. He spent all the money, you know, that we could have had for other things on drinking. He terrorized us kids and, you know, beat us up and slapped us around and he terrorized himself. You know, he really ruined a lot of his life because of drinking. And I thought, holy shit. You know, now I'm going to be a dad. And we're out hiking in the hills, you know, in Arizona, and it's beautiful. And we're going down to Mexico and, you know, it's beautiful down there. And I'm just thinking, and I just made a decision. My decision was this, that no matter what else did or didn't happen, I never wanted my child to see me the way I had seen my dad. I felt like that would be an unforgivable thing to do to a child. And I thought about that. Well, then what do I do? You know, what do I do if I never want my child to see me like my dad? I mean, I know when I open up a bottle of beer or take one drink, you know, I'm going to take 100 if I can. And I also could be a total fucking bastard when I was drunk, unpredictable, crazy. I mean, I was also the life of the, I was a lot of the time, I was the life of the party, you know, and I'm sure probably none of you have ever been the life of the party. Yeah, I see some smiles. You know, I could really be the life of the party. I could be entertaining and funny and all that, but I could also be really nasty and mean and just a fucker. And it seemed like I was more often a fucker to those, people who were closest to me, you know, and I don't know why that seems to be the case. My dad was the same way. Everybody in town thought he was the greatest guy. You know, they had it after a while, they had a town holiday after him, on February 2nd, Groundhog Day. His name was Earl. They called it Eldred Earl Day. And they had a big groundhogs thing they put in the bar. And one time they brought a donkey into the bar and people rode it around and crazy shit. But because he was such a great guy, no one ever heard him say anything bad or be anything but the life of the party. But then home, he could just be a bastard. And I saw that in myself too. And so I realized that the only choice that I really had was to repeat my dad's mistake for my own children, or I had to quit. And so I decided on that trip that I was going to quit. And I'll never forget it. My friends and I, when we went down to Mexico, you could buy really good tequila really cheap. And my friend was kind of a tequila connoisseur, and he made the best margaritas on earth. And so we were at the house. It was our last day there. And I call him Poe. His name's John, but his nickname is Poe. I said, Poe, will you make me a margarita? And he made me the most perfect fucking margarita on the face of the earth. Frosty glass, you know, nice and perfect, salt on the rim, everything. And I drank that margarita and I was like, wow, that was really good. And that was the last drink I took. And that was 25 years ago, April 16th of this year. Thank you. And I've raised a daughter now. She's 25. She's had some problems of her own. I later had a nasty divorce, which caused some trouble for her. And she had some substance issues of her own. She is now sober 2 years, and a great kid, really, really killing it. And I have, you know, my people here. I live in Vermont. I have a million really good friends, a lot of them friends through doing Writers for Recovery for the last 6 years, and a lot of them from outside of that. And I'm still a cowbird, though. I still feel really awkward in a lot of situations, but I accept it. I accept that some places, you know, I just don't feel like I fit in, and that's okay with me. And I've got the people who want to be my friends and the people who don't want to be my friends, and the people who don't want to be my friend, well, that's okay with me. You know, they probably got their own friends somewhere. And that's okay. You know, I don't have to fit in, with anyone, but the people I love and care about. And I've got enough of those, that it really matters, you know, to me. And I have a good life, and I thank, you know, none of it. I realize that none of where I'm at right now would be possible, without my sobriety. And I really am so fucking grateful for that. I can't even tell you. I never miss it. My partner, you know, will have an occasional glass of wine. She's not really a drinker, but she might. And I don't have, you know, that's okay by me. I can go out, I love music. I can go out to a bar and see a band. My friends can drink. I just, it's so just, you know, unwantable to me. It's just I do have a problem if I'm around people when they get really drunk. I just and I, when that happens, when people start to get too out there, I just quietly excuse myself, and I leave because I know it's not psychologically good for me to be in that kind of situation. And so I realized I'm still a cowbird after all these years. And I realized that my tribe is a bunch of cowbirds too, a lot of them. And I'm sure many of you are cowbirds. So if you've never recognized that before, get your feathers on. And join the group. And it's a happy nest we have here of sober cowbirds. You're welcome to join it. Or if you're not, that's totally cool. If you're a cardinal or a turkey or a blue whale or whatever you are, you can be that. So that's about all I have to say about that. I hope I didn't bore y'all to death, but I did just want to do one thing. If y'all don't mind, before I go, I've been just for this, I've been working on the call of the cowbird. I've been practicing, so I just wanted to just give a little cowbird call. So hold on, I just got to get my hands ready here. And I'm from Vermont, so it's pretty wild area. We have a lot of cowbirds. Are you ready? Everybody, I'll do it on three. One, two, three. Moo. Oh. All right, I'm working on it. What the fuck? It's not perfect, but I'll get it sometime. Anyway, thank you so much for listening to my story, and it's been really nice to spend time with you. Thanks. So I guess we open the floor to whatever anyone has to say.